And then let's go around and take roll. You want to start?
What? My name?
Yes.
My son Kim.
Okay. Robert Ford. Kyle M. Kyle M.
Abby.
Harlan.
Hi, I'm Yale.
I'm Indigo.
I'm Tom.
Me.
Rob.
And I'm Willow. And hopefully Theo would join us in a moment. Excuse me while I have trouble with my own esophagus. That's okay. So today there was a eugenics conference at UW, which was awesome. It was put on by their, they have a minor in disability studies. And so they talked about the history of eugenics in Washington, Washington being the second state in the U.S. to adopt any laws that had to do with eugenics as a treatment for being a criminal, for being lower class, for being the same. Indiana, my home state, being first, which is tragic, but that's okay.
Weak-minded.
Feeble-minded.
Feeble-minded.
Feeble-minded, yes.
That's
And so they gave an entire history, which the entire thing is up as a webcast. I will post the link to that on our Stimulus Wiki. But basically it was an attempt to make the burden on society lessened that when poor people were having children that they could not support, well, you know, it's criminals, etc., was the assumption, and so the upper class was then burdened with taking care of it. The conference is full of politically correct language that I apologize if I'm a little bit blunt in the way I word things because I had to deal with that all day. I assume you all know that I'm pretty caring and understanding in general. if not, we'll talk sometime. But basically, when people talk about eugenics, they talk about the Nazi Party and how they tried to cull entire histories or like entire cultures of people based on their beliefs or based on their genetic characteristics, etc. The Nazi Party got that idea from the United States, which already had these things implemented in our legal system. We still actually have some of these things on the books. Rapists, especially child molesters, can still opt to be sterilized rather than giving out full sentences, which is interesting.
Chemical castration.
Is it just sterilized or is it chemical castration?
That's a big difference.
What
does that mean?
Chemical castration is a way to, through chemicals, equivalently like cut off your testicles, so it's not like just that you can't breathe.
It's like inverse Viagra for the ball.
But it's,
exactly. It's
but it's reversible. It has to be a continuous treatment.
That's right.
Yeah.
Many people go off it. Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, so it's not permanent.
No.
No, you're administered a dose of something every day, and so you can't
okay.
get
so that
around.
Doesn't seem like castration. That's
no,
not
it's,
a treatment.
Well, it's a libido issue more than it is a function. But it ties into it supposedly, and it's a little less art in
I'm not sure which one, but there are people in other countries that have written essays on I have an issue with pedophilia or some such thing. I would rather, I realize that this is a big issue. I would like to be castrated, and so they offer that as a possible treatment for themselves. The other thing that was really interesting today was the reminder to me that if you follow my Twitter at all, you also have the reminder of, which is in order to legally be of a different sex than what your birth certificate has, you have to have gone through a sterilization process. So as a transgendered person, you cannot have children if the state is going to recognize you as such.
Wow.
Which is a big deal.
Question.
Yes.
If you, hypothetically, were a transgendered person but not gone through the sterilization process.
Right.
So you were a male to female, would you then be the male partner in a birthing process?
That's a big question.
Like, would you provide the sperm, I should say? Or would you, I mean...
It depends on the coupling.
Okay.
With gene therapy, which is what we'll get into, that's a big question. So that's a big history, very summarized. Next, it got into nature and nurture, and one of the reasons that eugenics actually kind of ever stands a chance even still is because it recognizes the combination of nature and nurture. That it doesn't just matter who your parents are, it matters who raises you, your parents in that sense as well. And so it makes a lot of common sense that eugenics might work at some point, but we still have all of these moral hang-ups about it for good reason. So that was another thing that was addressed today. And then there are, sorry if I'm going too fast, let me know. Positive and negative eugenics. Negative tries to weed out bad traits, bad being scare quotes for the audio, where it's like if you commit crimes, if you are transgendered, if you are certified as crazy, if you have a race that's other than what's ideal, etc., depends on what the sociology is at the time, that's tried, like, you're not allowed to have kids. Positive eugenics is trying to encourage people with good, again, in scare quotes, characteristics to have children. So if anyone else has seen Idiocracy, there's that whole thing about, like, smart people don't have kids, dumb people do. Positive eugenics tries to encourage those smart people to have more kids.
Is it, question?
Yes.
Is it positive or negative eugenics if you're people with quote-unquote bad traits, and let's just use sort of a general one like alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
Those people have kids, their children have a percentage rate of
mm-hmm.
being susceptible to alcoholism. Is it positive or negative eugenics if you're introducing some sort of treatment in the process to not telling them not to have kids,
mm-hmm.
but treating them for their kids to resist that?
That's what I want to get into. So eugenics in general is choosing good genes. That's what the actual word means, is selective genetics, basically. And so that's where I think our transhumanist group is really going to get to an interesting point that was not addressed at the conference today, which is, If you are treating yourself because you don't want to have to deal with something anymore, or you want to have equal access, or you want your children to have the same opportunities that the general public has, then that is technically eugenics. But is that eugenics in the same negative connotation that we usually think of it in?
Isn't that gene therapy if it's after you're born?
Right. Well, gene therapy is just a shiny new name for eugenics.
But I think eugenics kind of encapsulates the fact that it's going to be passed on to your progeny.
It's a pre thing, pre this entity.
Right.
Doctrine.
Yeah.
Whereas gene therapy to me says post entity.
Yeah.
You
well,
are
so
an entity and you
well,
go in and get.
Gene therapy, the majority of the time, is not something that you address or try to fix with gene therapy. The majority of the time is not going to be passed down to your children. It's just going to be for you.
But
it
that's,
can be. It could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's only a technical.
Yeah. But I think the eugenics, to at least to me, not that I know a whole bunch about the like etymology of the word or anything, like encapsulates like specifically and being passed on to, you know, further generations in that context. So gene therapy is like one method by which you could do that.
And so on that note, I want to make one more final big point before I open things up more, is people who have disabilities are less likely to have children, just in general. Not just numbers-wise, but percentage-wise, usually because of genetics. Disabilities do not actually pass on easily to your kids because it's more difficult for you to have kids. Disabilities that we have today are more likely to be because of fertility treatment. So if you are unable to have kids and you go in and have treatment done for that, whether or not you have any disabilities, in scare quotes, that we'll use a lot because of how politically correct things were and because we don't have good language for this, your kids are more likely to have issues. And today there were all sorts of talks about what it is to have a disability, if that's really a bad thing, if it's just society treating it as being a bad thing, if and like all these different things and all this different society and also biology issues, and that's just...
Where was that at?
Did I?
It was at UW. Okay.
I wanted to just throw out an interesting delineation that I've heard also in the disability community. I work with people in the universal design crowd and
mm-hmm.
how you design houses that are able to be used by people with all kinds of abilities or disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So it relates to it. And there's, of course, as you know, tremendous grassroots support, especially in the deaf community. That's not considered always a disability, but for most other people with profound disabilities, they are recognized as such.
Mm-hmm.
The big debate that I'm also hearing is between a physical disability.
Mm-hmm.
It could be spinal bifida, it could be a whole sort, as you say, from late pregnancies, from fertility. There's all sorts of induced disabilities as well,
mm-hmm.
as, you know, running the mill, passing on. But the big question is, can you identify behavior well enough yet? And I don't believe that, even though I'm a big optimist. I don't think we have it down yet that we could say if we could get that gene, that person won't become a criminal or won't be violent or won't be, because they're
right.
They're too complex and they're not just down to a gene or two,
mm-hmm.
compared to, say, some of the physical disabilities that are pretty well identified. That's my opinion.
So to kind of tie that together, the nature versus nurture,
mm-hmm.
There's a long term where no one realized that there were differences, and then everybody thought that it was one or the other or
mm-hmm.
some distinct percentage. Now the way that it's viewed is sort of nature determines the cards you're dealt, nurture determines how you play them.
Right.
So even if you get played a really shitty hand and you know how to play your cards, you can win.
Does that apply to something like schizophrenia also?
Yes. As far as identical twins that are born, if they're split up at birth for adoption, as rare as this is and the studies that happen with that, it's about a 50% chance, which means it's very genetically ingrained, but it definitely is based on what environment you're raised in.
Wait, can you go over that again? Whether or not you develop schizophrenia?
Right.
Or, okay. I was going to say whether or not you have it and
control
it.
Could be,
is it activated by the trauma of separation?
It would be activated based on your environment. Mm-hmm. But you would have the
schizophrenic mother or father in the sense that they create the problem along with the propensity of the genetic.
At least that's what it was
actually,
in school when I was there, like
yeah.
3 years ago.
Actually, was apparently sane and okay, but as a culture, the whole culture conspire to make you schizophrenic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's successful. Like, normal person in Soviet become a, better person.
Well, that's another thing, is that even though it's definitely, they can still find the genetic markers,
mm-hmm.
it's still not considered to be crazy, per se, if from one culture to another.
Right.
It depends.
It has a hugely different prognosis in different, like in developing countries, people
right.
with, diagnosis of schizophrenia have a vastly different prognosis than they do here, whereas
right.
here they're, institutionalized or medicated for their whole lives and just continue to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of communities in developing countries, they're integrated into the community and have a much better chance at having a fully successful
right.
life.
Same thing with aging. With people who are respected, and many other cultures here, it's like, you're done with your job, send them out.
The schizophrenics for all the shamans.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and
but
the transgender people.
That's right.
Yeah.
Somewhere like America, we're purposely, selecting against schizophrenics to, create more children with, but that's something
right.
that continues to be a presence,
yeah.
Even though we've only been around for, 200 years and people keep coming in. Isn't that something that would gradually, over time, go away instead of, increase, which is...
Well,
reading some statistics a little while ago that actually there are more schizophrenics than there used to be.
A couple notes on that. One is that as far as more schizophrenics now than there were years ago, it's the same reason that we think autism and ADHD are increasing, is because we just broaden our diagnosis
mm-hmm.
of them.
That's shiny.
Yeah. So that's a big part of it. Remind me what other things.
Well, as we select against it for, like, you know, mating purposes.
Right. That was another thing that every once in a while, like every 5 to 7 years, an article comes out in a scientific journal about how all the redheads are going to disappear because it's a recessive trait.
Right.
And so one would think that it's slowly going to be bred out, right? Because if you have, you know, two dominant traits for, or if you have dark hair, then people forget that you have, like, you possibly have a dominant and a recessive gene. And so if you have two kids, you could have one with red hair or blonde hair and one with brown hair. And it, but we always think that things are being bred out, but they aren't really. It would take a long number of generations for all the...
The way that genetics is set up, however you want to have it, God, natural, or whatever, however genetics are set up in people, it's set up in such a way that to get rid of things or to add things takes an exorbitantly long time. And so if we're trying to actively breed things out, we have to, I guess, speed up the breeding process,
right,
or stop genes, like, cauterize this recessive trait here before it gets passed on and then do that.
I'm not sure you need to cauterize.
I think
more of
yeah.
Terminology
is
better neurotransmitters coming out of
the... Just because a gene is recessive doesn't mean it will slowly disappear.
That's right. Just
right.
The
gene itself isn't any less competitive because it's recessive. It's the trait that manifests.
It's just misunderstood.
That appears less. But the gene, for example, well,
mm-hmm.
A bad thing would be, say, if the redhead gene means you have less children, then it would get bred out. But
yes.
The recessiveness doesn't make it less competitive.
Well, and it's, you know, it's less adaptive in certain environments. But I guess that's just
evolutionary.
Well, on that note, though, because we have such good health care and because we're so good at causing our survival, are we... that's one of the eugenics arguments, is that we don't have natural selection anymore.
That's not true.
I agree, but that's still one of their arguments, is that, like, we're not seeing who survives and who doesn't. We're just... Yeah, so we have to do that on our own.
But
we don't have natural selection.
Yeah.
I think I agree with that. We have sexual selection, but nature no longer kills us before we are able to reach breeding age.
Well, I mean, evolution always happens.
Nature.
Whenever you have replicators, evolution will happen. The nature of the landscape has changed, and the environment that we are evolving to has changed. But evolution is happening faster than it's ever happened before because of all these different population groups mixing together.
Sure, but what are the limiting factors? What kills us? We don't have any predators. We don't have any
HIV.
But because we're medicating,
there's still natural factors.
Yeah, and things like immunity, with immunity to broad immunity to diseases is a bigger pressure than it's ever been before with all these population groups breeding together. That's one thing. A lot of social things. Traits that get you in the system by the time you're 14, and then, you know, you're in prison until you die. All of the traits that lead to that scenario, all the traits that lead to you not breeding at all or a lot for some reason, which are a lot, and they have less to do with your ability to run away from a tiger and more to do with your ability to interact with all the other humans.
That's sexual selection, though. That's the social kind of...
Well, but
yeah.
Any...
That's the environment, though.
How is your social status, position, etc., not your environment? I feel like we need to define terms.
Yeah, when evolutionary biologists say environment, they usually think of, you know, the weather or... climate or predators.
So how is my interaction with a predator being another entity, not a social interaction?
That's...
Humans are predators too. I don't think an evolutionary biologist would look at a wolf that, say, is better or worse at hunting with the other wolves and say, oh, that's not natural selection, that wolf didn't breed because it couldn't hunt with the other wolves and get along with them, because that's not their environment.
Plus, I'm just using the distinction.
Yeah, but even in those distinctions, like climate, weather and stuff, consider somebody who's really susceptible to an atmosphere that has high pollution particulates in it. Like when I lived in California, I get croup all the time, and I almost died when I was an infant just because something in my body was like really couldn't handle particles well. So that was just like one thing.
Now, I totally agree with you that there's like nothing in nature except for biological viruses, like viruses, bacteria, and pollution that really affects us and each other, but I don't think you can argue that from an evolutionary biology standpoint.
How about this? How about if all of a sudden our culture influences us so that we only want to mate with redheads? Okay, so
yeah.
That's sexual selection.
Yeah.
There's nothing environmental or natural about that drive.
Right, but that's
then,
not where we
but
started.
Because we have the ability to facilitate desire for only redheads, we also have the ability to facilitate more redheads. Like, if you can use me, if we are cognizant enough to want more redheads, we're also cognizant enough to produce more. So I can dye my hair red.
Right, but we started in saying
to be at that level, I think that level is produced by being able to match that.
Yeah. I think you're trying to draw a distinction between natural and non-natural that I don't believe exists.
Well, isn't that what we're talking about?
But it's
isn't eugenics just non-natural selection, where we're making a choice to select?
It's a lot less natural. Yeah, I mean, so say something like, redhead is beautiful for whatever societal, political, blah blah blah, reasons that nobody really knows. That's not the same as someone deciding we want more redheads in the world. We're all going to choose on purpose to try to procreate with redheads for that reason. That would be eugenics of we want this trait in the world with people. We're going to try to do that, which is different from that girl's really hot. I want to fuck her, and then she gets pregnant, and that's how it ends up happening.
I'm only using the distinction that's in the genetic, the evolutionary books. They point to, say, a feature that has no, that gives no advantage to adaptation, right? Like a peacock's tail gives it no advantage to surviving, but it's selected for sexually by female peacocks.
Well, yeah, well, that's what natural selection is, because
that's a distinction.
Two quick points. I find it hard to draw a line between people not being part of a natural selection pot that we're talking about. And I also feel like it's on a percentage scale. Like, maybe we're combating natural selection. And so the percentage that natural selection affects us in our day-to-day lives has been reduced from when we were running from that tiger.
Because there's still cultures that it does.
Yeah, there's still cultural sort of effects that are not necessarily natural, but I don't feel like it's completely gone. Because if there was no natural selection, we'd live forever and get along, and the world would be just a ball of people.
Well, to bring it back to eugenics, what about if people say society demands, a certain image, tall people or redheads or whatever? Okay, is it okay to say I want my kid to be tall? I want to change my child before he's born. I want to change his genes so he becomes a redhead.
Well, I think that I think that a lot of what we're talking about here is the transition from what you might call natural selection to social selection, right? So I don't make that distinction between natural and unnatural or natural and social, but just because I don't make that particular distinction doesn't mean that there's not a good distinction there to be made. And even though there are things that hazard us mortally still, it's clearly, I think, worth hypothetically talking about, okay, well, we have technology to combat disease. We have technology, as you said, to make us live long enough to have children and pass some kind of gene vector along. So that being the case, we're in a privileged position, right, to decide what kind of gene do we want to pass along.
The question of right or wrong is
So it's really less about, it becomes less about creating. Hitler didn't want white people because they survived better than other people. He wanted white people because, for a lot of social reasons. And that's the transition that we're in, is we're at a point where now, you know, we may want tall people or redheads or whatever it may be, but we want them for social reasons. We want them for very human reasons.
Well, it's also interesting, another way to look at it is that this parallel nature of it, which is why it's sometimes ambiguous as to what we're really talking about. If you think of the standard genetic view as something that goes on over a long period of time, the time is a factor, and environment is, tends to be seen as very more instantaneous or ongoing with that individual. So the crossover, I think as you said, it's the social selection is the place where nature meets, you know, human design.
It's still very, very complex. I mean,
we don't understand anything yet about it, really. I mean, other than things like height and hair color. I mean, that's,
and this,
you could do that with
well,
just regular breeding.
I would argue about that though, to some degree, in that while we now have gene therapy and we can really influence the plants that we grow and the crops that we have, we bred featherless chickens. Before we ever had gene therapy,
right.
We bred that.
Exactly.
As my friend Pip, who I was hoping would be here, says, is he's very into the idea of mostly cultural, but also to some degree, like opt-in eugenics. So you say, I'll give up my eggs if you find the perfect match for me, and then people who are much more capable of raising this child will raise it and you'll have this amazing child. Like, that's awesome. It's very prone to do good for society or what have you. His quote is, we've bred Dobermans and Chihuahuas out of wolves. Why aren't we messing with ourselves? Like, think about what we're capable of. And again, I'm playing devil's advocate for him right now because I think that there are a lot of moral issues that go into it. We are already doing it. We're already breeding ourselves to be stronger. But if you remove the squick issue of it's just wrong because we had all this bad press that went along with it, like.
I don't know. That's why people think it's wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's. I don't want to say that it's wrong because I don't think there's anything inherently wrong in the concept as an abstract concept of eugenics. But going back to dogs, there's the whole German Shepherd debacle that we kind of ruined German Shepherds. There was a, I don't know if you all know, there was a prize-winning German Shepherd, I think like in the 60s or 70s, and it was like the top show dog, and it had this beautiful slope in its back, and it's in its sort of hindquarters, in its hips, and everybody said, that's beautiful, I want all German Shepherds to look like that. So this dog bred with as many females, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of females. And then as it got to the later quarter of its life, it had hip dysplasia and horrible hip disease.
Is that right?
My dog died. And then all German Shepherds
right,
since
exactly.
then
yeah.
have horrible hip dysplasia.
Well, that,
and I'm so, there's nothing wrong with wanting those traits, but it's really hard to pick
predict.
The right ones.
And that's what I said, behavior worries me more, because when people talk about eliminating violence, which I'm a very non-violent person. I have a whole bunch of beliefs that that's going to make or break
Abstractly
the world. And yet,
great.
I'd step back if somebody said they could affect that gene there, because I don't believe it's a single gene. In that sense, that it's that easy to pick behavior and match.
And as far as just doing one gene trait,
right.
there are a couple lessons you can learn from that. One is that if you have a very small gene pool, it's really easy to kill something off.
Right.
This specific example, and then I'll pass it off again, is the grapevine blight in Europe and in France. When they talk about old vines, it's because they survived the grape blight. Everything else, like I wish I knew more, but they transplanted all of these old vines over to America, which is why some of our vineyards are better than European vineyards, is because all of them share the same ancestry, which means that they were all killed out by the same thing. Because when you talk about HIV and AIDS, it's like, yes, there's a genetic trait that allows you to, in all likelihood, be immune to HIV/AIDS. That's amazing. But what if there's something that comes along that only affects that, and everybody's been treated to have that characteristic?
There's some disease that you can get.
Sickle cell anemia?
Yeah.
No. Well, that's...
Valerian and sickle cell anemia. Yeah.
No, I was thinking about this gene that makes you immune to... It's something with the white blood cells where you don't get HIV because you have a defect in your white
blood
cells.
Yeah, that's sickle cell anemia.
Don't come out.
Yeah.
It's different than sickle cell. It's something that enabled people to have immunity to the plague. So, in the people who are able to trace the ancestry, people whose ancestors weren't killed off by the bubonic plague have immunity to AIDS, and it's because of a defect in one of the white cells. I can't remember, but it's really...
Yeah, I think it's tied to Tay-Sachs disease. There's something about... It's tied to one of the like Jewish diseases as well, because they weren't dying during the plague, which is why they get blamed for it. But it is tied to like this other like degenerative nerve disease.
Yeah, it's amazing. But
well, it's like Mad Cow. I mean, the human version is quite tragic.
Yeah,
another one of these great examples. I didn't see it until you got to old, very old Jewish men. You didn't see it before.
Yeah.
As soon as the cows.
So, I think it would be good to have perhaps some, I don't want to call it humility, but reservations as to what can and cannot actually be read. So I was really impressed. There's an institute in Russia that decided to experiment with, how fast they could essentially replicate turning wolves into dogs. And so they started out with silver foxes, which are perhaps some of the animals that are most fearful of humans. And I think it was within 20 or 30 generations, they've come up with foxes which have serious problems not being around people. Like they're... It's kind of crazy, and they actually have to sell them for pets because they're so low on funds.
They did that in England also for the purposes of breeding foxes for hunting, and they decided that since they were going to keep the foxes in kennels when they're not off running around, that they were going to pick the foxes that were the least nippy and like maladapted, and within, it was something like 15 to 20 generations, they had dog foxes that basically couldn't do the same thing as foxes anymore. They how like dogs, they behaved exactly like dogs.
But I guess the greater point is this. Heritability is not necessarily limited to genes. That is, heritability is merely a correlation between a trait in a parent and a trait in the child. It could be, in fact, that something is heritable and yet difficult to teach, number one, and number two is then purely social. So it just happens that parents teach it to their kids with some relative frequency, and that it's difficult to learn it in some other setting. And so I think that there are a wide range of traits, including many behavioral traits, which are probably extremely heritable. I mean, there's a lot of things that people like to think are not heritable, which have a significant heritability component. For example, the propensity to buckle down and work hard, I think is, I don't know, it's the variable is called C. I forget what it's the actual name for it is. But, and there's all sorts of like personality traits which seem to be heritable to at least a mid-level in social science, which is like 0.4, 0.5.
There's also the overall diversity in the sense that you're going to find certain traits are more clear in certain people. You know, like we're talking about, say, diseases specific to Jewish people as one possible thing. But in general, I'm thinking of some people can't process wheat, for example. Other people can't process milk. We're talking about very basic stuff now. The point being that people are at so many different levels in terms of what they can do. Some do certain things very well and do other things very poorly. So any attempt to see sort of this equal image of humans across the board is doomed to failure, just in terms of the variability within both the genetic and how they grow up, what society they're in. And you really can't say, well, that those people should be bred out or shouldn't
right.
exist, because there's always these latent and unexpressed aspects, qualities, and whatnot.
And even if it were possible to uniform the sort of playing field of the diversity of humans,
right.
would be a great disadvantage to the species.
Exactly.
I mean, except with the caveat of the fact, if we bred to be able to do everything perfectly, I feel like that would be sort of the ideal goal, but that's not.
Until you find the disease that kills us instantaneously.
Right,
and
but I feel like that's what
we're... Right, exactly. It's like
I mean,
telomeres. As soon as we can get those worked on, we really will get some.
We're still working on that.
I know.
But they're getting there.
Turns out you need those.
Yeah.
You do, but in certain ways.
You're also talking about, from what perspective are we talking about, actually makes people different from one another? Because, I mean, from our perspective, I mean, you guys are all totally different. From the perspective of eternity, it's
yeah.
like we're all, just kind of the same unit. And so that all kind of depends on your perspective. And
something I just want to know real quick is that there was a time when eugenics wasn't shunned as some type of thing, or even just an idea for a
right.
nationalist group to do, but eugenics was a full-blown, primary course of breeding for some groups, like with royal families and stuff, and that went on for a long time. exactly, and, I don't know if there's really convincing evidence, but, the stories of, really interbred royal people getting, deep forms and being crazy in their brain and stuff.
That's very well documented, hemophilia among
yeah.
royal
well,
rights.
Part of that, though, is...
It was social.
Right. A lot
Maybe.
Of the eugenics that's occurred in the past has been attributing a lot of social traits
right.
to breeding. Whether or not it was because they actually acknowledged that it was because those parents were raising those kids and so they were going to have those traits that were associated with that class.
But I feel like that's not the case, because there must be, I don't know of any specific documentation, but there must be of upper-class parents raising lower-class kids, and the upper-class kids wouldn't accept the lower-class kids in the upper-class environment.
Right, but that's because they knew that.
Right.
Yeah.
If you didn't know where you came from, and there wasn't a tag on you, although my name is Portman, you might be treated differently.
And
right.
so what, again, what I really want to address, go ahead. What I really want to address here is that people are, in the past, everything has been about society, or things that we thought were genetically passed on that aren't, we realize now, or might to some degree, but it still has a lot to do with society. What about, they just figured out how to cure colorblindness in Reese's monkeys. Is it important that we do that to people? You can actually take someone who's alive and tweak that gene in them.
How'd you do that? Now?
No, they figured that out. I don't know the science, but they have figured that out.
It's a post-birth cure.
Right. It's a post-birth cure, but it affects your children. So your children will also not have that defect.
So
defect in quotes. And so does that...
It affects all the tissue in the body? Or it affects the sexual hormones?
Well, okay, so the stem cells reproduce to be different parts of, different organs, etc. And so the part of your brain and your eye that process color that cause you to have color blindness are the ones affected, because not everything in your body shares the same chromosomes and ribosomes.
I was just wondering
how
that would translate into hereditary things.
It's still passed on hereditarily.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Yes. So that's what I'm interested in, because everything else I kind of...
Well, and that's a good, starting point to talk about. We've talked a lot about why we're afraid of eugenics.
Right.
Right, but maybe we can discuss the ways in which eugenics might be viable or desirable.
Well, one thing that I think is interesting that I don't think a lot of people know is that eugenics, insofar as purposeful genetic selection, is by law required for anyone doing in vitro fertilization since the mid-90s. It's called pre-implantation genetic screening. So if you are having an in vitro birth for whatever reason, which happens thousands and thousands of times every year, you have all the sperm and eggs, and you know, you mix them together outside the body, and because of all the stress that that induces on the whole system of fertilization, there's a lot higher chance of things going wrong with fertilized eggs. And so, you know, you end up with, you know, 20, 30, 100 fertilized eggs, and then you let them all grow until they're a few cells big, and then for each one, you pick off a cell, and then you you don't sequence the whole genome right now because that's way too expensive, but you look for, you know, a list of 20, 30, 50 specific genes that are known to impart either miscarriage or, you know, like very, very, very bad disability. Or
That's no different than the social, the rich man, poor man we were talking about before, because it's an economic thing. If it was free,
well, it kind of is
to do it.
Because you're going to have 20 kids or you're going to have one kid. You're gonna bring all of those like fertilized eggs.
But
to, like,
since it costs so much to do in vitro, like if it was negligible or sort of zero cost on the parents who are having this procedure performed, then it wouldn't matter as much that they get one that is guaranteed or nearly guaranteed to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
They could just pick one, fertilize it, make sure it's growing, stick it in the woman. To not be very uncouth.
Well, but it's still, no, it's insanely invasive and really painful and really, I mean, very low success rate.
This is also, I'm just making the point that it's also a social eugenics and not a strict
environmental.
Right,
but I imagine that in Israel, in vitro is covered by the nationalized, everyone in Israel gets health insurance who's Jewish. And if you're Jewish, you get in vitro for free up to 2 live births, and that can take years to get 2 live viable children out of in vitro.
So that's like guaranteed live. You can come out in the end with 2 live kids. What you can do it as many times as you want.
Yeah,
so
until you get 2 live kids, and that's actually interesting. This is a little tangential, but I mean, Israel is practicing eugenics. They have an actively antinatalist policy for Arabs. They have no health services other than family planning clinics in heavily Arab areas, and there's, you know, people are really encouraged to have kids, you know, free in vitro, and it'll be interesting to see how that kind of pans out in the next few years. But I think that, I mean, in terms of it being a social versus a genetic thing for the in vitro, I think that it's still prohibitively invasive and uncomfortable. Even if money weren't an issue, I think there would be a real imperative to select for healthy embryos because it's such a low success rate and it's so uncomfortable.
So I want to make a point which I think people are maybe underestimating, I guess. It seems like people are really reticent to grapple with the idea that disability actually exists. Like, it really sucks to be paraplegic.
Yeah.
Most people who are paraplegic would rather have 4 functional limbs. That doesn't make them any less human. That doesn't make them any less worthy of respect. But they're disabled.
We
and it really sucks to have a variety of conditions.
Right, and that's one thing that I wanted to ask today at the thing was that people who are in this field and that want to further this this cause, their disability is a really big part of their identity. And the things that I've grappled with are a big part of my identity. I think that's probably the case for everyone, but it's not as readily apparent as it is for people who are extremely what we term disabled. And so there was one gentleman who asked, he apologized for being tactless, but he said, is being disabled a bad thing? And there was one guy in the audience who had cerebral palsy who responded to him, who's like, first of all, it is tactless because you ask someone who doesn't have a disability. You ask someone on the panel who does not have any clear disability. Like, they're fine.
There was that one guy. But...
that was in the earlier panel. And he said, you know, it's... the quote was, disability is a bad word for something the English language has no good word for. And so, basically, in short, diversity is good, and there are some things that we term as bad and things that we can prevent, but like Down syndrome is something that we test for in the womb. That's not a genetic trait. That's not something where you're helping all of humanity by stopping that birth from happening. Because people who have Down syndrome, when and if they're born, which we usually prevent now, can't reproduce. So if a parent wants to have a child with Down syndrome, that's their choice, but usually that's stopped even before they have an option about it.
So,
I know I'm really scattered.
No, that's fine. So, I mean, that is very true, right? So, I mean, you could theoretically say that for any number of conditions. Even if people, for example, have serious genetic disabilities, and they could reproduce, but just don't choose to. But, I mean, for most of the people that I know, there's also a pretty serious economic aspect to this, right? Like, most people simply don't have the commitment, drive, money, etc., to have an infinite number of children. They generally stop below 4, most people stop below 2, or at 2, I know. And so, while I don't want to say, and I would never say, that having Down syndrome children don't deserve to be loved or aren't human beings worthy of love and respect and all sorts of other things, I think that you would be fooling yourself to think that, I don't know how to say this.
There's an advantage to having them?
Nicely. No, I mean it's, Having one child essentially displaces having another child.
Oh, I see.
And so,
yeah.
if you filter out Down syndrome children, and have non-Down syndrome children instead, right? I mean,
is it right to bring about to life a child who's gonna grow up to have Down syndrome and have no prospect really? Or bring about someone who's, you know, is going to be blind for life.
Yeah. In other words, one could imagine being, wanting to have children, and one could imagine compassionate motives for not wanting to have a Down syndrome child or a blind child. Because we're talking about somebody who does not exist.
Consent is a big issue in when you want to, quote, prepare someone. There's two issues. One is before you're born, and there's no consent possible. Blindness, down. There's also another split between developmental disabilities, you know, mental, psychiatric, versus physical. Now, you know, everyone's probably read Stephen Hawking's view on this whole thing. He would very much like to have a new body. He's not finding a lot of fun. And most of the people who I've worked with when I was involved in input devices for disabled people to operate computers, I didn't find one person who liked being the way they were, but they all liked who they were.
Yeah.
Now that's an interesting thing.
So that's when it gets into gene therapy, is that
that's
if
right.
you could have kids and you could guarantee or nearly guarantee that at least they would not have the same disability that you have.
Right.
What are the morals on that?
Well, I think the problem with that is, you know, whose values are these? Who's, you know,
mm-hmm.
disabled to who? Advantageous to who? Is it there's no consensus in society as to what's desirable. So to what extent do we leave it up to individuals versus having, you know, an
mm-hmm.
external entity telling them? Because for some people, it's very undesirable to have a gay child or, you know, a blonde
hair
child.
There are some societal,
mm-hmm.
I feel like there are some societal lines that are pretty, not saying completely, but pretty universal, like Down syndrome and
quadriplegia.
survival past the age of 2.
I want to mention some of the historic eugenics. In Spartan times, they valued so much the warrior. So when someone is not fit for being a good warrior, the child was destroyed. So that's one kind of social eugenic. In Saudi Arabia, right now, you know, traditionally, if someone has a good fighting skill as a man, then acquire a lot of material gain, then that person was allowed to have many female, and some of the loser, you know, so-called loser in their culture, was not allowed to get married because already occupied, you know. And if someone violated that, that's a federal crime by. And then in Britain, they discovered the left brain, modern brain. So anybody who is smart in left brain, you know, scheming with some left brain skill, they dominate as scheming upper class. So it's they can have more, woman or marriage, even some other clandestine relationship. So it's kind of less so in than Saudi Arabia. But at the same, in America right now, the trend is the banking system, is combined with the federal bank, issuing the money. They are the major exploiter of money gain by time, by just riding time, using time. So everybody is in. It's not a good word as enslaved, but exploited by this mathematical game by federal and bank alliance. So they will have advantage as eugenic. So this is.
Socially.
But in the future, if a society develop much enlightened, and if there is a beautiful woman. And more beautiful woman, it will create more advanced motivation from male and become genuinely good society, then they will breed or cultivate more beautiful woman because that create more geniuses. And even in men, they will not select bankers as the best marriage material geniuses. Creative people, artistic people will be valued. So it depends on the society, from old Spartan culture to modern culture of left brain into future value system. And that is eugenic in a positive sense. Or
I think what you're saying is that there may not be a social consensus of what is really good right now, but there is a group that has a material advantage to be able to put forth a consensus of what is a desirable trait, and they have a better chance of bringing about that desire for that trait in a larger group that may be sub to them.
Well, it is interesting that historically speaking, and probably in the future, these groups are usually temporary. Any eugenic benefit they have is slim to none, and that usually any advantages they have can be wholly attributed to the social climb involved.
But they're still gaining
change.
Yeah, but they're still gaining the upper footing, and even if what is valued is changing, they're still.
Here's a question. Like, I think the argument about social engineering is kind of gets left out of the question of eugenics, because especially if you're looking at issues of disability or something like that, you've got two approaches. Okay, you want to remove disabilities from the population so that everyone has a better time, or you're going to change the culture to provide better for the needs of disabled people.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you need both.
If you're actively,
you got to deal with the people
eugenics
who are here already.
Any sort of approach to eugenics is going to basically be kind of amplifying what's already within the culture, and it just focusing on narratives like that. But then when you have social upheavals and stuff like that, so any time that you're setting up a social structure or you're continuing a social structure which benefits one group of people at the expense of another, you're essentially conducting eugenics right there.
I'm going to have to disagree that. I think the term eugenics, too much is attributed to genetics.
That's kind of the point I'm making.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. It's not very genetic.
Genetics is meaningless without the environment.
Any group that's at the top always attributes the fact that they're at the top to their better blood, better genetics, better whatnot, and then, one day you're not. Guess it wasn't that good. And if anything, especially if you track cultural movements in the United States over the past 100 years, you can actually watch groups come up and then go down and then come up and then go down. And every single time they're down, someone attributes it to their genetic inferiority. And every single time they're up, someone attributes to their genetic superiority.
I'm not sure bringing social concepts of higher, lower classes or whatever it matters, because it's more of a biology issue. If you're not having a lot of kids, then your genes aren't going anywhere, right? So a lot of times people notice that it is the lower classes that have more children, then that's a selection in favor of the lower classes, right? So it's not actually the upper classes that are having any advantage at all for them being rich or being, wealthy or powerful. There's no advantage to that in terms of gene pool.
That's a hypothesis I never quite bought, because when you also take into the huge disadvantages that come with being poor, I'm pretty sure it probably washes out any statistical social bump.
The disadvantages happen after you have kids.
It's counterbalanced by the probability that
20,
those kids are going to have kids.
Whatever happens to you, after you have five kids, whatever happens to you doesn't matter.
But there's they're reproducing more, but there's also way higher infant mortality and probably higher infertility rates due to certain diseases. And I agree that there are more births in that segment of the population. But that brings me to something that I want to talk about that it seems like we're kind of skirting around, is the biggest issue I found when I was sort of researching arguments against transhumanism. One of the biggest ones was eugenics and the idea that there's going to be people who have the economic means to choose traits for their children. And they say, if we get to the point where gene therapy or where genetic selection pre-birth is super good, we can say, if people have money, they can say, I want a tall, strong child with immunity to AIDS who has, an IQ of 150 or whatever, and who's super brilliant and super athletic and really fertile and all these things. And gradually, once people with money have the ability to put these traits into their children, there's going to be this sort of genetic, superhuman.
Yeah, it's widening the gap.
But
exactly.
An interesting thing, though, just to hammer some hard science into that one, if we're learning anything about genetics, is how tremendously important environment is to the expression of genetics. You can genetically program someone to have 150 IQ until the sun comes up. But guess
and
what?
Then you can give them private tutors for 20 years and send them to the best colleges and make sure that they meet everyone they need to.
Which
is already happening. If you are adding in this additional set of advantages,
I don't think there is any
morally defensible way of implementing eugenics which doesn't apply some kind of social leveling effect. If you are simply using that to reproduce existing categories of social hierarchy and magnify those to the utmost degree that we have a scientific method of doing so, there is no socially acceptable way of doing that.
Why not? Why is that not acceptable?
Because
you're in a hierarchy where there are the supermen and the slaves.
No,
that's what you're creating there. There is no way to avoid that if you are not going to try to apply some.
But
kind of
the slaves will eventually become extinct. Now, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing.
No, that's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying that the opportunities are there, right? Just because there's someone who's really amazing doesn't limit the opportunities that I have.
Yes, it
yes,
does.
It does.
If there's some resource system, if I take all the food in the world, you starve.
Well, that's
done.
That's not a zero. I mean,
no,
society
it
is.
Is
not.
Is,
society
so
is not. That
is how
zero
it works.
Sum, right?
Okay, we are finding
they're,
out that the world
mutually
is a
beneficial
very, very
reaction.
Harsh zero-sum resource system. We are finding out just how zero-sum
okay,
resource
wait,
world
what,
is.
What if we're if we're doing
yeah.
all of this theorizing about a super race, why not breed in compassion?
Right.
Like, what? Why is...
And
if
there
we're
is a genetic component to that that's
yeah.
elucidated now.
Or
we always so assume
or
that...
Question,
I have passionate God is better.
I'm serious. There's a question that keeps coming up. Everyone's talking about wanting to genetically engineer all of these traits. Why don't we adjust our social system to encourage these traits in people already?
Okay, so there was...
So at least then we can have something we can start with. Because, okay... To bring it back, for instance, if you take a look at, have you read about the so-called Obama effect?
Yeah.
Yes.
Which, right, everyone has read about this, I assume. No? Okay, so traditionally, black students always test lower at high-level tests than white students. Always. Just it statistically happens so often. It's one of those horrible things that on the liberal side, they always try and kind of talk their way around it, and on the conservative side, they kind of just go, interesting. For instance, the bell curve. However, a very interesting thing happened after Obama got the nomination. It vanished.
That's awesome.
It just gone.
And so what they've shown is that if you're not asked your race or your sex, the stereotypical, like, men do better at math than women. If you're not asked if you're a man or a woman, it doesn't matter. If you are asked that, then women do less well.
Now, is this...
Which could appear as a genetic component.
When in fact, it's
not.
Just social.
It's a social.
Exactly.
But is it... And I don't know the answer to this, and I don't mean to sound insensitive. Is it that we don't see the difference, so we can't attribute it to that, or is it that?
It's because it's so ingrained that you don't even, like, even,
but,
me
okay.
as a...
perfect
we
example.
If
you do
we don't
blind
ask that, but if we know,
it shows up.
If the researcher knows, but the participant isn't asked to assign themselves or to define
that's
themselves.
What I mean.
Yeah, I think it's the researcher knows what gender and race the person
okay,
is.
Okay, and then they do the study the same way, so they know there's X amount of women and X
right.
amount of guys,
right.
and they're all of them.
Not
okay.
And,
it's if the participants
and really what it basically
know.
Is, basically
right.
is,
but they're
is
being asked, yeah.
when you get into a high stress situation, every little doubt counts.
Okay.
And if you have the slightest twinge of doubt, you choke. It's just
and
human psychology.
Sure.
What we do.
Something I want to say though, the idea, I think it's wonderful the idea that you know, you want to create a level playing field socially before you start implementing these genetic things. And I think that's absolutely, we need social engineering before we start genetically engineering. But it's an issue of consensus. There's
right.
never going to be consensus in a country, I mean, anywhere, at, you know, what we value, because we value, you know, we value compassion and nonviolence. There's a project called, that's like to make a conservative Bible, to edit out all the liberal things in the Bible, to edit out all the times Jesus talked about peace and nonviolence and loving your enemy, to have a good, you know, conservative Bible with what, you know, it's really supposed to be.
How many words are left?
Well, most
of
the
Old Testament.
And
yeah.
The Book of Romans.
I whittled it down fast.
And, but it's really, my point is that there's going to be, I mean, if you look at a capitalist market economy, there's people already have the option to send their kids to super good private schools and get them tutors. So even if there's a kid of average ability, it can be given such tremendous social advantage if its parents have money that it cancels out any
yeah.
potentially.
But is that an argument against enhancement or for? Are you saying that we shouldn't give these kids tutoring, or we should take away these amazing colleges that students can go to?
I think the argument is that the debate over genetic enhancement is kind of a straw man, and that the issues will be much better addressed by looking at the social issues in play.
There
can
was
we have both, though? Can
we
well,
we
have
need
both
a leveling of
social
the social playing field.
Right.
I think
which
that's
is
absolutely a good place to start.
Yeah.
Exponentially more difficult the larger society.
Yeah, but
you can
do things by example. You can't do the whole culture.
But if we had a country the size of Rhode Island, everybody could agree, and then we could have a level playing field and implement genetics.
then I think you have
but
to
have
resolve.
So,
the moral issues raised by the structures of power before you go fiddling anywhere else.
So there was a quote from today that I want to bring up right now that I think sums it up really well, what we're getting at right now, which is change minds, not bodies.
Right.
We have a lot of social shit we need to figure out before we can address other things and still be sane in any sense about it. And that was one thing that plagued me today, which I'm sorry to derail anyone, but was we have the ability now to end a lot of things that put a lot of people at a disadvantage. It's difficult to call those out while at the same time still valuing the people that possess those traits. So if we can end autism, which is not a genetic disease, but just as an example, if we can end autism and we go on a huge campaign to do so and we throw all these resources at it, etc., what do we do with the autistic people we have?
Well,
like my point for tonight is that we're not ready to figure any of this shit out. But we're also never ready for anything.
Right.
So
how can we are ready for the
future
physical,
back?
Though? Not so much the behavioral changes. I kind of agree with you that we're just infants in this whole business. But I think we can address certain profound illnesses that keep a person from getting anywhere near their maximum. In other words, there are certain diseases that are pretty amenable.
Mm-hmm.
That are not necessarily behaviorally related, which in turn are really not clearly genetic. They have so many cross influences that I agree we're not ready to do that.
So,
but I think there are things we could get at after right now.
I'm sorry. Abby, Indigo, and then over here.
I think this may seem absurd to people, but I think a good thought experiment when thinking about what it's okay for people to choose for their children, a lot of people be like, oh, I don't want my kid to be gay. That's not in my values. So they, you know, have their kid, they choose for their kid not to be gay. And another thing is, like, how far are we willing to extend people's rights to alter their offspring? Like, if somebody wanted to have, you know, 20 kids who would be super good workers so they could have, you know, and their own lab or their own factory or their own organic farm, right? Like, I want to breed children who are really docile, who are really dumb, who are good, who, like, are really easy to train. Are we okay with that? Are we okay with people breeding their kids to be worker drones? And, like, how
well,
far are we willing
no.
to, like, good, like, what values are we willing to breed in? What are we willing to breed out? And what's the consensus? Like, what is the rubric for deciding what is acceptable to do to your offspring? What's desirable?
I have a suggestion for that, but I'll let the other people, as she already did before.
So here's another thought experiment. It's kind of like a opposite corollary to that. Imagine a public health campaign like happened with the vaccination of like the entire world and the elimination of smallpox, right? So that happened. Imagine something on that scale, like modeled on that was a gene therapy vaccination to eliminate, say, muscular dystrophy. Muscular dystrophy. There's a lot of things that you could pick.
Huntington's.
Like, I don't see how it's ethical to have the ability to do that and not do it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
To
everyone,
though.
Yeah. To everyone who needs it. I mean, I agree with you about the level playing field, because otherwise it's an affront.
Yeah.
Someone over here have a comment?
This was about what you were saying earlier.
Okay.
We're not ready to go there. And what would happen to all the people who had, I think you said autism, today, if we sort of put a stop, there's no more autism, there's no more autistic babies in the future, right? And I think that's ridiculous. It would be great if there were no more autistic babies in the future. And and if you want to remove the sort of cultural maybe issues going on here, I mean, what would all the people with eyeglasses do if all babies from here on out never needed eyeglasses in the future?
But that's not necessarily a part of your identity because it's so casual.
What about people with glasses fetishes who get like huge sexual pleasure out of
We'll
purchases?
Always have frames. So, we'll always have but
okay, but like, those people will just not be autistic. That is, the people who would have been autistic will just never exist.
There's a problem I have with that, and that's that I have autistic tendencies, and I don't know that those autistic, they're very, very mild autistic tendencies, and I tend to think that some of those autistic tendencies correlate with some things that I'm able to do very well. You know, we were talking about earlier about there being a spectrum of things. You know, there are a lot of people in the world that probably have mild forms of schizophrenia and are phenomenal artists because of it.
Right.
Or whatever. So to say that it would be great if there were no more autistic people ever, I think that's a very solid black line where maybe a solid black line isn't warranted.
Yeah.
I mean, even getting back to something we talked about earlier, along those same lines with colorblindness, there's nothing that says colorblindness is not necessarily a benefit to those with it in some artistic or abstract sense. And also that it's purely a genetic trait.
So I think a better example would be Huntington disease.
Right.
Huntington's does not, the experience that I have in studying it, which is pretty limited, there are no benefits from that.
Right.
Like, people with autistic tendencies, people in that spectrum, operate well in situations that are emerging, that were, like, that can be a good thing.
Yeah.
Huntington just devastates you. It devastates your family, and it doesn't manifest until after you've already had
kids.
It's
a deeper.
But you're grown up by then.
But are there traits that people with
Huntington's
disease have that correlate with Huntington's disease, but we don't realize?
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing, though. But
that's
getting into the very dangerous sort of puritanical mode of suffering is somehow good. I think we can kind of agree on something. As a culture, I bloody well hope we can agree on this. Suffering is bad.
Right.
Yeah. Dying is bad.
It builds character. Not dying, but suffering.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be who I was if I hadn't gone through Catholic schools and non-Catholic. Like, I think that's
why. We're not talking about going through Catholic schools. If you're in pain
that's
time,
enough.
Like
that's enough.
Pain.
Yeah, I want to express your opinion. That's
right.
We accept your opinions. But I want to say something. No. Huntington, that's a different story. Autistic, the modern theory is that too much testosterone or sex hormone makes perception sharpen. Your ear is sharpened, eyesight is sharpened. So that kind of person is more involved in perceptive process and less investment in higher mode of controlling brain. So it's different. If that kind of person has a different investment and strength, less manipulate autistic people, I suppose. More genius, more creative, less manipulator or multitasker. So there is different talent there. But I want to say my real thing, not retorting. And there are two ways of social progress. One is like a Korean way, or Japanese, or even Chinese. The other one is Norway. The outcome of this, unlimited competition from the parent and child, going all kinds of schools and the training school, the support school, create in the 100, 200 years later, 10% of people high class, 90%, 80% become slave class. And they become a loser. And it's polarizing more and more. And where is the good people? 90% of people become low class because of competition. Norway becomes second order thinker as a society. So everybody go much better sane society.
Rising boat lifts
everybody. Yeah, everybody. So the foundation itself is up.
A is better.
But
the B is better.
Chinese, Japanese, Korean, in you know, unlimited competition, you know. And that's the hell, you know. That's why they you know, China, 80 or 90% was a slave 100 years ago. Korea, the same. 100 years go back, 90% people slave. Japan, 90%.
United
not only,
States, we have a huge
not
state
only that, Japanese become even pygmy because of the immense exploitation by the samurai class, the worker class become pygmy.
I don't see a problem with having that structure.
No problem.
I'm not that liberal to say that everybody should be the same. I think that everybody should have opportunities to become more than they are. One of the problems with Willow's statement is, I think you made it too, is that why don't we fix the structure that we have now, fix the society we have now before we look at enhancement? That's kind of like saying, why don't we fix the Earth before we start looking at other planets to go to? I think we should always be looking beyond our own problems, because that gives us a drive to become something more and better. Whereas if we always try to go back to our own faults, like what's wrong with us, how can we fix what we are,
then we get stuck. Two things are just around there, I guess. One, how about the fact that one of the best indicators for a level of violent crime in any given society is the disparity between the richest and the poorest people in that society. The greater the inequality, generally the more violent the society is.
And less stable in the long term.
And less stable in
the
long
term. That's why
And then the other thing is, the argument in favor of there being a stratified society or there being big differences between people relies on kind of, I think, a rather erroneous notion that we need competition amongst ourselves in order to improve our lot or to have some sort of drive. But I mean, the idea that we need competition in the healthcare system to drive innovation, it seems to me that like competition is with death and disease. Like, you already have something I think that should be the competition, not amongst, fighting amongst ourselves as to who can provide the best healthcare. But you can make pretty clear checkpoints on your marks to successfully developing a healthcare system. You're like, well, have we managed to cure this disease? No? Okay, we need to try harder.
You can compete against pollution, and you can compete
to turn those human characteristics. I mean, if you have gone beyond the scarcity model of how the world functions and imagine that there's someday an abundance model, how do we get from here to there? And you mentioned about the social equality, the level playing field is the key thing. So that is something we can do now to conceptualize a better future, but I think we should be doing these in parallel. I don't think we have time. There's no reason why
one has to exclude the other.
They're not two different things. Like, there's one caveat to moratorium, on these things we're speaking of until social things are made better. Like, let's imagine, the versions of ourselves 150 years ago sitting around this table talking about, this imaginary smallpox vaccine or something that would be developed, and somebody says the argument, well, only the rich will be able to afford this vaccine, and so the rich will stay healthy and the poor will get this disease, and that will just increase the divide. And then that neglects to honor the relationship between technology and health and society. And it's like, then you don't have people dying of these diseases, and that bootstraps your way up into making social change easier.
There's a difference between augmentation and healing, though.
Right. But if you're talking something like curing muscular dystrophy, like that's kind of like the obvious red herring one. That's like a cure. Like this is definitely a continuum of things. And on one end you have I don't want my child to be gay, and on the other end you have I want my child to survive past the age of two. And there's a lot of things in between those, and no clear distinction of where that is.
Yeah.
But there are a vast number of cases where these things, where social advancements can be aided by implementing those biological changes first.
Which was the point I was trying to get across. across is that there are some things we can't agree on. That if we could stop, if we had the power or the technology to stop people from dying in pain and we didn't use it, then we're negligent as a society.
And it's not a question of, well, we can't do that because we can't just go down that road until and because of all these problems that will happen. We started on that road.
Yeah.
You can go
yeah.
to clinics in Europe and choose the sex of your child. You've been able to do that for 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the things that are on the table publicly aware of.
Shit, you convinced me.
And I think we do need to research things in parallel, and I think it's absurd to say, you know, moratorium on scientific research
yeah.
because we don't have all these things implemented. But I think that in addition to really pushing forward research, there needs to be a concomitant push towards things that we already have that we can do that we're not doing. Like the smallpox vaccine is very low tech, very low cost for inoculation. I mean, they discovered it because people were, you know, grinding up pustules and snorting them, and that's, you know, it's really easy to do, it's really easy to distribute. And there are things now that are comparable that we could be doing that make such leaps and bounds in public health. Like,
but you can make so much money if you just patent it.
Right.
A
but like,
polio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well,
I was done with polio.
People,
if we just get
people mosquito
here.
Nets,
yeah.
giving
yeah.
people
exactly.
access to clean water. It's so cheap. It's so freaking cheap. It's like one day of our war.
But you know,
would give everybody clean drinking water. But it's there's not the political or social or whatever will to.
So how do we do that?
As consumer, there is an upside to having a lot of people that works against the poverty argument, which is you have enough people, you reach a critical mass where the business model becomes selling volume, not expensive things to a few people, selling cheaper things to many people. That's
like
that,
telephones,
everything
like
is,
mobile phones.
Why
are
cell phones 2 billion
mm-hmm.
in the world? 2 billion cell phones. How did that happen? When were we
three.
Not looking? Three now. It's even, see, I missed last week. But that's my point, which is that there's ubiquitous quality that can be exploited in a positive way to use the leverage of the sheer numbers of people in the world to bring the cost down so you can make the, not the enhancements necessarily first pass, but the repairs that are really agreed on, physical repairs, but then maybe we'll develop the sophistication to actually say what these behavioral things are.
Yeah.
I don't think we're there yet.
When like cell phones were really, really expensive and only actors had them, I remember in
yeah,
India.
Exactly.
Now everybody has them. So it's not just, oh, you can say that, oh, we shouldn't have cell phones because it only
right.
lets the richer people call your friends.
You hit a critical mass and suddenly the business model changes and suddenly we don't care about if some of the wealthy people buy specialized ones, but everybody can have a base.
Yeah.
So we're like water and food and housing.
And I think part of what he was talking about is that when, okay, let's just say the rich do get access to something, it's not like, I don't think history has shown that the rich will always be like, this is mine forever, and only the rich will get to have it. Once they have it, they're like, if other people have that, then, you know, it increased productivity. And I don't think people at a material advantage are necessarily always greedy and evil. And I mean, philanthropy and all these other things exist. And, you know, resources and capacity, technological capacity, has to, you know, get into people's minds so that they can start thinking. And you need that to happen. But there's three points I really want to make, that I wanted to make. The first one is that when it comes to genetic, fixing a genetic or hereditary trait that, or augmenting one, that none of us, I don't think, are really, you know, too schooled and knowledgeable about how genetics work in a really detailed way. And there's something that I think is that you can't just start chopping off what you want and putting in what you want. Our genome is not necessarily, doesn't have an infinite capacity to take in all the traits we want to put in it. I mean, there's some type of stasis that goes on with the amount of information that can be used and the system that develops because of that. And I think there should be a reservation of how far genetic modification can really go under the current idea of just, you know, gene therapy, bring a gene into a tissue and hopefully that gene will be accepted. The second, the other point I made, I already made with the rich people getting stuff, but let's see, I don't really remember what the other one was. I know this always happens when I talk, but somebody's saying something over there that made me think something.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Theo?
I guess I had two things that I wanted to say. First of all, you're entirely correct about sort of spectrum type. I know what you might call
continuum
disorders or whatever you want to call it. So, I mean, certainly beyond autism, there's a variety of other things that have a broad spectrum of effects. And, you know, I'm not somehow saying that we should all be identical. Certainly that didn't work out well with bananas.
No, no, it did not. No more bananas, get them while you can.
I guess the other thing I wanted to say, related to hierarchy, and I guess this is one of the things which, I know, I guess I'm pretty much convinced that there will always be hierarchy. Not necessarily because people think that hierarchy is a good thing, although I'm sure that some people do, but simply because some people are better at doing a particular thing than other people. Some doctors are better at being doctors than other doctors. And while there's a significant component of education and things might have turned out differently if people had done different things, if different people had gone to different schools, they didn't. We have the people with the particular skills that they have today. And I don't know, I'm pretty happy being operated on by good doctors as opposed to, I don't know, random people from society.
Let me try it.
There's a social choice, though, as to whether or not you reproduce those hierarchies across generations.
So, however amplification may work, I'm agnostic, but I find it difficult to believe that we will ever be hierarchy-less. That
well,
is, that everyone will be equally good at doing everything.
But
I
think
that's but
there's a
that,
difference between
those
saying that you're going to reproduce hierarchies over time and saying that everyone will end up being equivalently good at everything in a given generation. Reproducing hierarchies over time are what cause that kind of long-term social problem. If everyone is somehow starting from a nominally level playing field, you know, and a functionally level playing field, and yeah, they find their own course in life, but you know, there isn't that, oh, you're coming out the gate, you know, six lifetimes ahead of, you know, the person born the next second.
Well,
that's
we're going
to
start choosing those hierarchies, because I'm sorry, I can't remember the name. We were talking about...
This is Abby.
Not Abby, behind Abby.
Kyle. Oh,
Kyle?
Kyle.
This is Tom over here.
Tom. Okay.
It's Kyle.
You, Kyle, yes, Kyle was talking about how you could only fit certain amount of traits in any given genome at any given time.
It's a hypothesis.
It makes sense to me that you can't just pack it with everything that you want. So we're going to have potentially a grid of artists and doctors and writers and lawyers, and you say, I want my child to be a lawyer, and so you pack him with the lawyer package. So now he can't be a doctor, but he's a lawyer. And then, I mean, that's a sort of crude model.
Then how is that any different than having... caste system.
I'm saying it's not any different.
Yeah.
It's that even we're not going to be able to genetically breed a level playing field because we need specialization. And so.
But that may not be genetic stuff, though. The way to get those specializations.
But you can, you could, you know, pack someone with the potentiality.
But not
to be
so
specific.
What about
now,
packing them with
like,
potentiality to be a good doctor if they choose to be a doctor,
right?
Or a lawyer if they choose to be a lawyer.
Here's
besides,
a really
most
simple
of your
layer
genetic
to that.
Structure, you know, are errors and stuff left over of evolution. It's an interesting side fact. I'm sure most of you know this from familiar genetics. Is that the majority of what we think is our genetic structure are mistakes, errors, repeats, just noise.
Well, of course.
By our system.
Yeah.
And so you might have to ask yourself: is that really true?
Or do we just
not
understand
sure. We just
all
don't
the
understand
theory.
It. And
that's another argument that's coming out that maybe we only see a fraction of
DNA.
It.
Yeah.
Like they always say, you know, like 90% of your DNA is this junk DNA.
Yeah.
All that means that's like the definition of dark matter. Is we stuff that
right.
we don't get how it works yet.
Exactly.
So we assume it must not be important.
It amazed me when I heard that. I thought, well, we only are talking about a minority, and how can we really be that expert?
Okay. So specifically, there was recently this awesome article on how people who perform LASIK surgery now, they don't have to give you 20/20 vision. They can give you better vision. And so if you're constantly, you know, if you always have to look at something that's really far away, they can give you the eyesight that makes you really good at that. And they can, if you're always looking at a computer screen, they can optimize you for that. You can choose the eyes you need now.
You can even get an implant if you're a filmmaker.
Yeah,
there
are
in fact specific surgeons who work on like baseball players who will tune their eyes to see a baseball moving against a grass field. That is what their eyes
exactly.
become good
right.
at.
Right, which is awesome, but that's not genetic.
No, it
like,
is not.
That's something that's changing. So
that's what I was saying about the training for doctor or lawyer is not going to be genetic, but I agree with your point that the propensity to do that kind of work might be.
Yeah, well, it seems like people have been equating specialization with hierarchy. Like the, I don't feel like having certain people that are specially adapted to say, you know, being a doctor has anything to do with hierarchy. Hierarchy means people are adapted towards being a doctor because if you're a doctor, you have a better chance of having satisfaction and happiness in your life.
Right. In a heterarchy, you don't have homogeneity, but you also don't have hierarchy.
Yeah, exactly.
You have people cooperating with each other based on their specializations.
Mm-hmm. But given that social functions are ascribed to economic values, you have an implicit valuation across the hierarchy.
That's a problem with the economic system.
Well, we have to tear down capitalism, and then we'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's right. But exactly. But that's a social structure,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not an inevitable anything. It's certainly not an inevitable consequence of genetic modification. But I think it speaks to the idea that hierarchy and homogeneity are not the only two options. Real quick, this is a bit of a gear shift, but I wanted to reply to Abby's point about the rubric. I think that possibly I'm going to suggest a place to start, and this isn't certainly a place to finish, but if you ask, now there are a lot of gay people that I know who, if you ask them, you know, if you could take away your being gay, would you do it? And they would say absolutely not. Now they identify with being gay, okay, but that may not be here or there. Now the people that you ask, if I could take away your colorblindness, if I could give you the ability to see color, would you take that? Yeah, absolutely I would. Maybe because you mentioned consensus, maybe the place to start looking at eugenics is the place where people
on if identity and community are built around it, maybe.
Well, maybe, but if people, if it's something that people would choose, if asked, if you could be without paraplegia, if you could be without colorblindness, would you? And they respond yes to that, then it's a candidate for eugenic modification.
Right, and that's
if they wouldn't.
That's
if they wouldn't, then you wouldn't. Now, where you run into problems with that is when you go to Israel, because you're going to have people that say, I would opt to be a Jew every single time. It's not necessarily a problem. I'm just saying we can't make eugenic decisions for the entire species because the values are too different.
Right. So you have to be consent oriented. That's the whole thing in medicine in general. I think that separates the whole business between when you do something to someone without their consent versus they sign up and they want to get repaired or enhanced.
Also,
that's an adult.
Yeah, and you live on Capitol Hill and you know in Seattle. And if you ask people here if they if they're happy being gay and they're content and they would want to be gay again, yes. If you go to a conservative Christian community and ask closeted, miserable people, would you be gay? They'd say, hell no. If you go to Saudi Arabia, ask someone, would you be gay if you could choose?
But
I
that's based on whether what the community around them has to do with it. And so that's when I say, are there identities and communities that are built around it? If there are, then it's either something that's useful, or it's useful in a vague, overarching term, or it's something that society is not yet ready to get rid of. If it's something that there's no community around, like colorblindness, I don't know if there are any forums online for people who are colorblind, but I doubt that it's a part of their main identity.
What about the deaf
community?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are communities
area.
Built around
exactly.
that, which means that it shouldn't, like, we shouldn't put any pressure on that to be gone. Get, like, to be
that's
gone.
Right. But is it acceptable for deaf parents to
that
select for deaf
children?
Yeah,
that's a good one.
Especially if they're getting government funding.
But I think that that's the crux of
right.
any kind of, I mean, real eugenics is, you know, I mean, really we're asking the question, what do we value
yeah.
our children to have? And the... So then we have to then ask the question, is there a distinction between I want my children to be gay or not gay, or I want my children, my child to not be, you know, say paraplegic. I mean, are those both completely arbitrary things? Or is there a reason why we should prefer one of those over the other?
In the sense of pure social relativism is all completely arbitrary. That
yeah, but if you say everything's arbitrary,
yeah, exactly.
Nothing's
it's
arbitrary.
Exactly.
So
it's
use
one of those,
the word arbitrary.
It's one of those nonsense statements. It's one of those nonsense statements that is nonetheless factually true. However, a society cannot function on that assumption. You do have to set a standard in your society of past this point, it's okay, it's fine. Beyond this point, no. There has to be that line, otherwise you just can't function. Because you'll step on each other's toes on a constant basis.
Well, no, that has to do with societies that are based on written law and societies that are just closed and self-regulating. Self-regulating societies have to do with how far off of the baseline you are at any given time.
Right, okay.
In law, like written law societies, it has to do with arbitrary lines. It's not about how far before and after that you are. It's about whether you're on one side of the line or the other.
Legally, but socially is not always legally.
Another,
right, exactly.
Another
social.
Oh, I just wanted to throw this into the mix really quick, because this is something Francis Fukuyama, my favorite person, something he brings up is like, what if you give your kid a trait that's acceptable? It's like, they've okayed it for eugenics, but your kid hates you for it. Like, he was pissed off when he became tall. What if he could really blame his parents and say, you guys decided for me to be tall, I hate you, like,
yeah,
why did you make me this way?
That's already true as far as consent goes. I mean, to, you know, to the vast extent that, you know, your formative, the formative years of your life decide, you know, who you are for the rest of your life, like, you know, your parents are already choosing to a large extent who you're gonna be just based on what they do to you in
sure.
those years. It's already like that.
But there's not, it's such a gradual, I mean, it's such a holistic, integrated process
mm-hmm.
that, you know, becoming who you are psychologically and spiritually and emotionally, mm-hmm. it happens over time. But if you could point to something and be like, you know, my parents chose to give me double D breasts.
Yeah, but it's,
yeah.
But it's not like that. Because
how
the
yeah.
like as far as genetics goes, it's like I don't like the view that you have genetics and then you have nature, and there's these two things that interact. Like, genetics decide the context under which the nature affects you, you know. So it's so I like, at least, you know, right now tampering with things genetically is far, far more unpredictable, messy, and ill-defined than social determination.
Let me give you a contradiction to that. A great debate goes on about intersexuality. I'm not talking about so much transgender
mm-hmm.
now, but
mm-hmm.
decisions that parents can make about an infant
yeah.
as to what gender they're going to be assigned. Now, there's a great example of lack of human rights
yeah.
because people I know who have been through that, when they are adults, are often very angry with the parents. parents, the surgeons, the whole society, in fact, who made that decision, when in fact they could have decided that when they were adolescents on their own. And that's a simple one. It's not a, you know, genetic thing per se.
So I think that would create even more of a resentment for your parent if you're unhappy with where
exactly.
you are right now, to know that your parent had a choice to make things different.
And so it's, so the idea, it behooves us to think of the behavioral and the identity issues and, you know, who you think you are as a person. All that stuff should probably be left to the person when they, as they get older. And the stuff that so clearly barriers quadriplegia, spinal bifida, I mean, I can think of probably 1,000 obviously genetic things that the kid is not going to be angry with you for solving.
Sure.
Yeah.
But the moment you get into identity and choices like sexuality, forget it. That's really personal.
I think that's my main objection is that there are things that your child may choose not to be.
Right.
If you give it to them, that can create dissatisfaction or change the parent-child relationship.
Yes.
And that's kind of brought up, you guys might all have seen Gattaca, but this main character was created to be perfect, but he wasn't. Like, he failed that competition, and he hated himself because, like, I was created perfect, why wasn't I
right.
the best? So it could create, you know, psychological problems.
Fulfillment. I mean, that's always a casualty of competitions.
And we hate to blame ourselves.
I'm gonna
we need to stop because they're gonna close here in a couple minutes, and it's awesome.
I have some logistical thing before closing.
Yeah, they're closing up here.
Before this closing, our group.